Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, RFERL's regular podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Mike Eccles, senior correspondent here in Prague, filling in for our regular host, Steve Gutterman. Last week may have been the most consequential week for European security and stability in years, maybe in a generation, maybe since the collapse of the Soviet Union. In Geneva, Brussels, and Vienna, negotiators from Russia met head-on with diplomats from the United States, NATO, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. The subject in all three places was pretty much the same: Russia's demands to essentially rebuild the security infrastructure that has existed in Europe since the 1990s. What does that mean exactly? Well, from Moscow's perspective, it means no more NATO expansion into countries like Ukraine and Georgia. It means NATO military infrastructure is pulled back to pre-1997. It means Moscow gets guarantees of no medium-range missile systems in Europe, no strike weaponry in Ukraine. Here's Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Grushko.
Diplomacy is about talking, and without talking it will be not possible to achieve results. We are ready to continue. But it should be meaningful discussions. It should not be a repetition of so-called slogans or principles. We have to have a shared common goal. Our common goal is sound new security systems in Europe based on the new principles.
The United States, not surprisingly, is pouring cold water on that. So, too, is NATO's leadership.
We were basically saying to the Russians, some of the things you've put on the table are non-starters for us. We are not going to agree that NATO cannot expand any further. We are not going to agree to go back to 1997. We are not going to agree that everything that is in Europe has to get out of Europe. There's a lot we can, however, work together on in the arena of transparency, deconfliction, communications, arms control, and a whole variety of other areas where we could move forward.
That was Wendy Sherman, the number two official at the U.S. State Department and the lead U.S. negotiator in Geneva and Brussels. And all the while, there are more than 100,000 Russian troops massing along Ukraine's border, threatening a new invasion. So, was there anything positive to come out of last week's talks? Is there any glimpse of a way forward? Are we hurtling toward war? And what comes next for Moscow? It sure seems like there's just one man who's holding most of the cards these days. That would be Vladimir Putin, and he's holding those cards close to his chest. Joining me now to discuss all this is Kadri Lik, a senior fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations and a longtime Estonian foreign correspondent. Dobro pozdravljat. Welcome, Kadri.
Hello. My pleasure.
Also on the line is Sam Green. He's a professor of Russian politics and director of the Russia Institute at King's College London. Sam, welcome.
Thank you.
Let's start with Kadri. Last week's talks, is the glass half full or half empty, as the saying goes?
And that question is hard to answer, because I think what we saw in public sphere was reiteration of positions as laid out previously. The Russian delegation repeated their proposals that they had also given in written format and made public. And the Western side, in different forms and shapes and institutions, said what they thought about it, which was that they didn't like them. So seemingly it is deadlock. Of all Russian demands, only the ones that concern arms control have some prospect of being heard, and the United States is willing to discuss. However, I'm not sure that's the end of the story. I think that diplomacy might somehow still have some more acts to play. So let's see. And you're obviously right that it is Vladimir Putin's decision as to whether to continue with diplomacy or do something else. And I don't think that even Russian diplomats actually know what are the next orders they will receive from the Kremlin.
Sam, what are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, my thoughts were very neatly summarized by Kadri. I wouldn't disagree with any of that. I mean, to me, the major outcome of the last week or so of discussions, I wouldn't call them negotiations, right, but discussions, is that, we're not at war, or we're not more at war than we were before, right? Russia and Ukraine having been at war now for going on 8 years. But things at least didn't get worse. And that really is, what diplomats are there for. If we take the positions of both sides at face value, or in terms of what's been publicly said, it's a reasonable question as to whether we do want to take them at face value. But if we do take them at face value, then, Moscow's position is one that has been forming and deepening and hardening, since 1999, at the very least. Whereas, the Western position, the NATO position, the U.S. position, however, whatever format you want to look at it from, is also a very longstanding approach to security in Europe, and in fact, more broadly than that. So to imagine that this would have been somehow, settled over 3 days of discussions is probably too much for anybody to have hoped for on either side. I think we do have professionals and reasonably realistic people at least in the foreign ministries on both sides. And so I think that the best we could have hoped for is what we got, discussions that may continue in some form or another, and that seem to have been enough at the moment to prevent Moscow from expanding its invasion of Ukraine.
Of course, as you say, it's Ukraine and the deployment of Russian forces along the borders that has pushed this situation to an outright boiling point. Yet we didn't seem to hear a whole lot about Ukraine, at least publicly, during last week's talks. They got mentioned a couple of times in a couple of venues, but it didn't seem to be central to the conversation. Sam, would you agree with that assessment?
I think there's a rhetorically difficult position that Moscow has painted itself into, which is that this is fundamentally about Ukraine, and yet they don't want the Ukrainians at the table, and that's a very difficult position to maintain if you're trying to maintain any kind of public legitimacy. So I think that's part of it. The U.S. obviously also made a commitment not to talk about Ukraine without Ukraine being at the table. So that's also part, I think, of the calculation there, right? But the demands, such as they are, right, that Moscow has put on the table, are not demands for Ukraine to fulfill. They are demands for Washington to fulfill, if Washington feels so inclined, right? It's Moscow's interpretation, or at least just public interpretation, of how the world works and how security in Europe works, is that the decisions are made in Washington, and so from that perspective, to the extent that really it was Moscow that convened this particular set of discussions, that's maybe not all that surprising.
Kadri, how sustainable is this tempo of threats and rhetoric and escalation and de-escalation for Russia? How is it possible that we could see a long-term frozen conflict situation in Ukraine, like pretty much Russia has done in Moldova and Georgia? And that would pretty much accomplish what Russia wants, which is blocking Ukraine from NATO membership.
Well, that is a situation that exists de facto. I mean, the conflict in Donbas, okay, it's not as frozen as it could be. There are people dying regularly, but even so, I mean, that's the situation we have already. So I think Moscow really wants something more. Moscow wants Ukraine to be locked in with Russia for the foreseeable future, at least, to make sure that Ukraine does not slip away and get closer to the West. I think what got President Putin moving, it was a combination of things, but it had to do with the Minsk negotiations stopping to produce the results that Moscow wants, and they essentially gave up on that. They saw that Ukraine was receiving Western help that made it more able to resist any Russian offensive and so forth. So actually, they wanted to review the situation. And yeah, to the previous question, I agree with Sam that Russia wants essentially to discuss the things that are the West to deliver and not Ukraine's. To add just a bit of Kremlinology here, I think it's also significant that President Putin asked the Russian Foreign Ministry to handle that full file and to come forward with proposals, because it's, you know, for the Foreign Ministry, it has always been, whenever these matters are discussed, they say that, you know, first there must come a new European security system, and then Ukraine's place in it, and then everything else will follow. There is a sort of systemic legalistic view of seeing things, whereas, you know, for some other players in Russian system, it might be sufficient to just have some agreement on Ukraine explicitly, and to create sort of sui generis around Ukraine. But of course, from Russia's point of view, if there is a full new European system, then that would make everything easier to handle.
Speaking of Kremlinology, here's one point that personally I wish would get a harder look. How much are internal domestic politics driving Kremlin foreign policy? As we all know, 2 years from now, Putin's current term as president is supposed to end. He's now constitutionally able to stay on for yet another term, and theoretically he could be president until 2034. Will he do that? We don't know. But so maybe all this saber-rattling is just Putin trying to cement his legacy. Maybe it's for his domestic constituency, paving the way to the run-up to the 2024 election. Maybe this helps fend off potential rivals or a successor, a succession struggle. Kadri, what do you think about that?
I think that yes and no. I mean, I don't buy the logic of diversionary wars, or the idea that Russia launches wars abroad in order to boost the regime popularity at home. That question, it's not settled. There is debate on that even in Russia, and sometimes, you know, people who analyze domestic politics in Russia say that, of course, everything was domestically inspired. Foreign policy analysts would say, no, there was foreign policy context. My impression so far has been that true proper hot foreign wars have the foreign policy related strategic calculations behind them. That said, I think domestic context does play a role. I don't still exclude that President Putin might consider leaving in 2024, or at least he wants to be able to, and he might view Ukraine as, yeah, something he wants to settle while he's in the office. Not least because maybe for the next generation in Russia, the whole Ukraine thing matters a lot less. And Putin wants them to face fait accompli when he leaves. Or he might want, yeah, to have it somehow settled before elections. Political, there is some logic in it. So I don't accept the sort of primitive interpretation of that proposition, but I think, you know, some logic or some least direct linkage might well be there.
Sam, what do you think about that?
You know, I try not to think about it, to be perfectly honest, because I don't know what Putin is thinking. I don't know what Putin is thinking because I can't know what he's thinking. And because I can't know what he's thinking, I try not to build my sort of models of how Russian politics works around, you know, what's going on in his head, right? I think that there are certain things we do know from analyzing his behavior and just from looking at how, you know, people in who have structured power similarly to the way that Putin has, you know, behave and the incentives that they face around the world and throughout history. And we see that Putin very much conforms to those patterns, right? He's interested in the prolongation of his own power. I think Kadri's right. It could come to a point where he would feel like he could step back. We won't know when that's going to happen. But even when he does, he will want to be protected and feel that he's secure within that. And if you look at recent events in Kazakhstan, for example, that looks like a much more difficult proposition than maybe it did even just a few weeks ago. I think he has to think in terms of threats to his longevity and the longevity of his political project. Those threats are primarily domestic. I think it's true that even though we did see sort of a rally around the flag after the annexation of Crimea, that didn't. I don't think there's reason to believe that was the reason that they went into Crimea. They certainly didn't know ahead of time that it was going to produce that kind of result. And if we look at public opinion now about Ukraine, we don't see a population that is itching for war, despite 7 or 8 years of very belligerent propaganda from Russian state television and the state more broadly. I think there are political risks involved with the war. I think that it's it's not clear what a war would deliver that would be useful for him. On the other hand, right, confrontation with the West is baked into Russian politics. Right, it is a core element of his legitimacy. It's also a core element of how he deals with the opposition. At this point, to be oppositional in Russia is to be treasonous. Right, and he and the state have lined up the opposition very clearly with the idea of a foreign threat, particularly a Western threat, and betrayal of Russia's national interests and its sovereignty. And it is nigh on impossible to imagine him ever being able to pivot away from that, even if he wanted to, right? So maintaining this kind of confrontation, maintaining a difficult relationship with the West, in fact, is probably actually in his political interests, as Kadri was saying, preventing Ukraine from slipping away. I think not because of some sort of imperial nostalgia or because of the fear of having a democracy next door that might set a bad example from his perspective for Russian citizens, but because of the pressure that an EU-integrated Ukraine would put on the Russian economy to reform in ways that would be detrimental to, again, Putin's political longevity. Sorry, a long answer to a short question.
It's a long answer for a very complicated question that isn't going to be resolved, certainly not today, and maybe not in the coming weeks, although they indeed will be critical for the Kremlin, for the White House, for NATO. Thanks to you both for joining us today. Kadri Lik, Sam Green, spasibo ogromnoe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for us, folks, today. This is RFERL's Week Ahead in Russia. Thank you all for tuning in.